I have an impressionable 10-year-old daughter in there, and this is not one of the impressions I want her picking up. Now you get that rising young actress the hell out of there.
Out of where? Out of my rented apartment that you are staying in out of the goodness of my heart?
Welcome to Presenting Alfred Hitchcock Presents, presented by the Ann Arbor District Library. I'm Al Sheridsma, and that was Marsha Mason, movie star, back when she was a movie star, after appearing in Cinderella Liberty, Audrey Rose, The Cheap Detective, Chapter 2, and Only When I Laugh. Those last three were written by playwright Neil Simon, to whom Marsha was married from 1973 to 1983. Her best-known role, also courtesy of her husband, is that of Paula McFadden opposite Richard Dreyfuss in The Goodbye Girl, from which came that clip I just played. Which brings us to, what's that? Excuse me? Oh. I've just been told that the title of tonight's episode is not Marsha Mason Movie Star, but Martha Mason Movie Star. As Gilda Radner's Emily Latella used to say,
"Oh, that's very different. Never mind."
So, unfortunately, Marsha Mason is not going to appear in this episode. But that's okay, because Martha Mason isn't going to appear either. Now here's Hitch. He is climbing down the ladder from a spaceship, and while he wears his regular coat and tie, he also wears a transparent bubble space helmet.
"Good evening. I've been on Mars, where I went for the opening of a new television station. It's all part of a scheme to take the best of our cultural advances to the Martians, or Martinis, as they prefer to be called. They are highly intelligent, and my attempts to educate them were quite successful. Within a matter of minutes, they were able to spell out, 'Earthman, go home,' using my two companions to form the letters. It was very gratifying. As you have doubtless already guessed, tonight's play is entitled, 'Martha Mason, Movie Star.'"
It will follow in a moment after this moth hole in the fabric of our entertainment. The announced title of the episode is such a lovely non sequitur from what he was talking about before. So here's Martha Mason, movie star. First broadcast on May 19th, 1957. Starring Judith Evelyn and Robert Emhart. Teleplay by Robert C. Dennis, based on a story by Raymond Mason, and directed by Justice Addis. This is Judith Evelyn's second and last Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance after Guilty Witness. This is Robert Emhart's fourth of six Alfred Hitchcock Presents and one Alfred Hitchcock Hour appearances after Don't Come Back Alive, De Mortuis,
De Mortuis,
De Mortuis,
De Mortuis,
and Crackpot. His next is The Right Kind of House, episode 23 of season 3. This is Robert C. Dennis's 14th teleplay out of 30 after Don't Come Back Alive, Our Cook's a Treasure, Guilty Witness, The Older Sister, The Derelicts, Place of Shadows, Help Wanted, The Orderly World of Mr. Appleby, The Belfry, Crack of Doom, John Brown's Body, Nightmare in 4D, and One for the Road. His next is A Little Sleep, episode 38 of season 2. And this is Justice Addis's sixth directing job out of 10, after Salvage, A Bullet for Baldwin, Safe Conduct, Nightmare in 4D, and The Night the World Ended. His next is Our Next, The West Warlock Time Capsule, episode 35 of season 2. So Justice starts us out with the sound of an alarm ringing and a shot of an alarm clock on a bedside table reading 7:30. A hand wearing a white glove reaches into the frame from the bed and shuts the alarm clock off. The camera pans left to show us the owner of the arm and the white glove, and she is lying in bed, well covered, wearing a black sleep mask, a cap, and a chin strap. She sits up in bed, but does not get out of bed.
Henry!
Coming right up. Sorry, my dear. I'm afraid I overslept this morning.
The camera cuts to Henry entering the room and follows him as he puts a cup of coffee on the table, grabs a pillow from the other single bed in the room, uses it to help prop his wife up in bed, and then guides her hand to the coffee cup. Henry is played by Robert Emhart, and his wife, Mabel, is Judith Evelyn. After Mabel settles in to drink her coffee, lifting her black mask, which may or may not be a hint that she's the villain of the piece, Henry sits on the other single bed. His territory. Television shows of the time did not show married couples sleeping in the same bed together. And even if they had, I have no doubt that this couple would have separate beds. Not for want of affection on Henry's side, but on Mabel's, whom we find out very quickly has little interest in Henry and his doings.
The lodge lasted till all hours. The reading of the treasurer's report is very interesting, though.
That may be interesting to you, but I don't want to hear about it.
As they converse, Henry gets up. The camera follows him as he goes over to a bureau with a mirror. We get a nice shot of Henry in the mirror, brushing his hair, with Mabel in the background, still in the bed.
You know, I don't like to go away and leave you alone like that, but it's only once a week, and the lodge is important.
Why don't you join another one, then?
Oh, no, I wouldn't want to do that. Belonging to a lodge is every man's civic duty. But joining two would be selfishness. I'm not the type of man who'd neglect his wife and his home.
Mabel does not respond to that, so Henry looks down at a magazine sitting on the bureau. He picks it up, and we get a close-up of it. Now, I said at the beginning that Martha Mason does not appear in this episode. That's not quite true, since she is on the cover of this magazine, Film Life magazine, with the caption, Life and Loves of Martha Mason. Now, if the app Actor Detector has steered me in the right direction, the photo of Martha Mason on the cover is a photo of actor Catherine MacLeod. There's a very nice mini bio by Gary Brumberg on IMDb, which reads in part, of Scottish descent, Catherine MacLeod was a self-confessed movie fan as a child of the Depression. Born on July 2, 1921, in Santa Monica, California, she was convent trained. She became a theater cashier in Dallas for a time before returning to Los Angeles and studying at an acting school. A talent scout discovered her in a play and signed her to an MGM contract in 1944. Now, she started in bit parts, but she got a lead role in the 1946 film I've Always Loved You. The IMDb mini-bio says, Catherine has to grow from a naive 18-year-old girl to an embittered 45-year-old woman in the film. Here she is as the naive 18-year-old.
I have taken you in music as far as I can go. Goron, if only that were possible.
Why go on up when I have you? Besides, I may win the scholarship.
Scholarship? But you don't understand, Myra. Goronov, the Goronov, he says that you have great talent.
Oh, he was being kind for your sake, Papa.
Not about talent, my child. About women and wine and politics. About anything, Goronov may agree with a friend. But not about music.
I think he's rude.
Well, Goronov is Goronov.
And Goronov is rude.
And here she is as the embittered 45-year-old.
Why did you do it? Why did you marry that man?
Because I loved him.
That's impossible. You married him because you were angry. You were hurt. For all those years, you have been unhappy.
That isn't so.
And why did you come here? To have me listen to your daughter? What difference can it make whether she plays well or not? She is a woman. And once long ago in Rio de Janeiro, I told you, there is no woman in music. You remember?
I remember.
Well, it is still true. Music is a man. It must be so because a woman is a woman. This daughter of yours will go out into the world. She will meet a man and acknowledge him to be your master. That's good. That's as it should be. As it should have been with you. Because I am your master.
You're wrong.
Catherine also appeared as Elizabeth Taylor's older sister in Courage of Lassie, as Donna Meachie's love interest in That's My Man, and in the films So Young, So Bad, Sword of Venus, and A Blueprint for Murder. Starting in the 1950s, she began appearing in a number of television programs, including Maverick, 77 Sunset Strip, Bonanza, Gunsmoke, and Marcus Welby, M.D. And she appeared in a few of the anthology shows we love so much. She's in the suspense episodes Criminal's Mark and The Guy from Nowhere, the One Step Beyond episode Contact, and the Outer Limits episode Soldier.
He is a product of artificial birth. He has no real parents. He was born and raised in a hatchery just like an egg. The state is all. His mother, his father, everything.
How pathetic. Can we help him? He seems so lost and confused, and you said yourself he's capable of... anything.
Abby, I know we can help him.
But are you sure, Tom? Tony, and Lauren upstairs with him alone?
I know. I know it's a terrible risk. But we can help him, and we must.
She also appeared in 40 episodes of the soap opera Days of Our Lives. But as Wikipedia puts it, McLeod's greatest impact upon American consciousness by far was as purveyor of one of the most ubiquitous catchphrases of its era, when she portrayed the woman in the 1963 headache remedy Anacin television commercial, who plaintively but irritably said, "Mother, please, I'd rather do it myself."
Don't you think it needs a little salt? Mother, please, I'd rather do it myself. Control yourself. Sure, you have a headache, you're tense, irritable. But don't take it out on her.
You need Anacin for fast relief.
Her first marriage lasted only a couple of years, but in 1950 she married Don Kiefer, whom we will see in just a few episodes in The Indestructible Mr. Weems. And that marriage lasted until her death in 1997 at the age of 75. If that's indeed Catherine, as Martha Mason on the cover of that magazine, and you call that an Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance, this is her only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance. So Henry puts the magazine down and then turns to talk to Mabel directly.
Well, what's for breakfast?
I don't know. Why don't you see what's down there? Couldn't you fix something for yourself this morning?
You wouldn't want me to go to the office with indigestion. Making coffee is the extent of my skill.
But I don't feel well, and I really should sleep in.
But you said you were going to get up early this morning, remember? There's a new movie with that actress that, what's her name?
Henry knows perfectly well what her name is. He just looked at the picture. But he's also clearly irritated at his wife. And we get the sense, from the expressions on Robert Emhart's face, that this is a daily frustration, and he must tamp his anger down. Needling her about Martha Mason is one way he can do that. But with his next words, his sarcasm becomes a little too obvious.
You know, the one you look like.
You think you're so smart. I'll bet you keep the lodge in stitches.
With this, Mabel sits up in bed, removes her chin strap, her eye shades, and some little triangles pasted to her forehead. Your guess is as good as mine. While Henry picks up the magazine and brings it over to compare Mabel with Martha Mason face by face.
Martha Mason, of course. I don't know why I have so much trouble remembering her name.
Mabel turns her face away when Henry does this, as if aware of the fact that Henry is mocking her. But she has a very slight smile on her face as well, as if she is flattered by the face-by-face comparison.
Sir, I just don't see any resemblance.
Oh, get out of here.
She swats the magazine out of his hands and he turns and walks toward the door.
All right, my dear. You call me when breakfast is ready. I'll be down puttering around in my garden.
So what's this about puttering around in his garden? Wasn't he going to go to the office? Is he just going to putter until Mabel makes his breakfast? Does Mabel ever make his breakfast? We never do find out, but we have gotten a decent amount of exposition. We have learned that Mabel is slothful and is trying to slough off whatever little work she seems to have in the marriage, meanwhile being unappreciative of Henry and whatever he does in their marriage. Henry is clearly frustrated, but cares for her and pampers her, but at the same time teases her about her belief that she looks like movie star Martha Mason. And we learn that Mabel is going to the movies today to see Martha Mason. We also learn that Henry has a garden. One thing we think we learn is that Henry, once a week, goes to his lodge. And so we fade out and fade in to see Mabel leaving the theater after watching the film. She stops at the movie poster, which shows Martha Mason in a mink coat, swooning in the arms of a policeman. The film's title is at the top of the poster, Forgotten Woman. Right below that, it says in big block letters, Martha Mason. In the lower right-hand corner, in smaller print, are more names, which I think are only significant in that they help to make it look more like a movie poster. Most likely they went by too fast at the time for anyone to read them, so you have to admire that they actually took the time to do it. Let's give them their due now and trot those names out, courtesy of the pause function. Who knows, maybe they are the names of the poster maker's friends. So here goes. The film co-stars Frank Chandler, Ralph Lord, and Rose Norton. It's directed by James Boyce, with a screenplay by Jack Capron. Let's get back to Mabel, who, still eating popcorn, imitates Martha Mason's swoon in front of the poster, only to be embarrassed when two women leaving the theater stop and stare at her. The music dissolves into the sound of Mabel's car as we dissolve to Mabel pulling into the driveway, where she almost runs into Henry, who is coming out of the garage carrying a big sack of fertilizer on his shoulder, looking just as he did at the start of De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
When he carries in the bag full of cement.
Well, how was the movie?
Oh, it was all right.
And your favorite actress?
Oh, well, she is always wonderful. There was one part... I wanted to scream. The police came to give her the bad news, and she just stands there for the longest time without saying anything, and then she faints.
Still sitting in the car, Mabel imitates the faint again.
Cut.
What?
Cut. Isn't that what they say in the film studios when they finish a scene?
Oh, well, if you're going to be so smart... I'll have you know that when I was coming out of the movie, everybody was turning to stare at me.
Why? You look all right to me.
Oh.
Oh. You mean they thought you were Martha Mason?
Now, Henry does love to stick a pin in Mabel's balloon, but as I said before, he clearly does care for her, and he tries to get her involved in his own interests.
Why do you waste your time in that silly old garden?
Well, I'm not wasting my time. This is a new system. You see, you dig down several feet, then you put this underneath the plants.
Oh, you've never been able to make anything grow out there yet, and you never will.
Now, this is guaranteed. And I'm making some frames, too. Come on, I'll show you.
Oh, I can't stand the smell of that stuff.
So Henry goes off alone with his bag of fertilizer, and we dissolve to Mabel sitting at her vanity, putting her hair up as she looks in a mirror to her right, and to the magazine with Martha Mason on it to her left. She has made a poor attempt at imitating Martha's hair in the photograph, and she holds up an earring like Martha has and tries to smile like Martha does. But Henry is hammering something outside, and this irritates her.
Henry, will you please?
All finished. Come on out and see it.
I don't want to see it.
She lies down on the couch, picks up a magazine, and starts to read it.
Come on out and take a look. I really got something this time.
It'll only take a moment. Please come out.
Oh, shut up and leave me alone.
Mabel, did you hear me?
Yes, I heard you. I don't want to see your silly old garden.
I got something special to show you. Mabel!
Mabel gives in and comes outside, where she sees Henry standing in a hole that he has surrounded with a wooden frame, into which he has poured the fertilizer. In this shot, she is in the dominant position, because Henry in his hole has made himself much shorter than her.
Now I can cover the plants with glass in the cold weather.
Well, what plants? Nothing's going to grow here.
You just don't take much interest in anything I do.
But you don't do anything interesting. Henry, I suppose it just never occurs to you that being married to you is pretty dull.
Too late now to do much about it.
Huh? We could get a divorce.
No, Mabel, I don't approve of divorce, and you know you don't mean it.
With this, Henry has stepped out of the hole and walked over to her so that they are now on equal footing.
You've got a nice house, a new car, all the clothes you need. And you're much better off than you realize.
I could sue for divorce, and there isn't anything you could do about it.
And what would you live on? You wouldn't get any alimony, I'm afraid. You have no grounds. And my friend Judge Dubbins doesn't approve of divorce any more than I do.
Well, maybe I could change his mind. After all, I know a few tricks for the witness stand.
Mabel starts mugging, as if being seductive on the witness stand.
Oh, now I get it. That movie today. Martha Mason must have been on the witness stand. Well, my dear, life isn't like the movies, and I'm afraid you don't look any more like Martha Mason than I do.
Well, this is the exact wrong thing to say to Mabel. And then Henry makes it worse by going back down into his hole, putting her back in the position of dominance. Not only that, but he bends over to spread his fertilizer, making himself an easy target. And he has left a hammer sitting on his wooden frame that Mabel looks at, and we get two close-ups of before she picks it up and, we presume, hits him over the head with it. I say presume because we don't see Henry in this shot at all. In his review of the episode at barebonesez.blogspot.com, Jack Seabrook says, "The scene tries to be comedic, or so it seems from the jaunty, inappropriate music that accompanies the violent murder. I call it violent, even though her weak swing with the tool appears unlikely to harm anyone, much less result in the death of her large husband. And let me add that her swing seems unlikely to connect with him, as his head is all the way at the other side of the frame. Nevertheless, it appears to have done the job, and as Mabel goes into an interior, overly dramatic monologue, she grabs the spade and starts filling the hole back up with dirt.
He drove me to it. I begged him to release me, to give me my freedom. He refused. He taunted me. He was cruel, inhuman. I couldn't stand anymore. I did what any woman would have done. I killed him. And now I'm free. 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 Free."
Bringing us to the commercial. When we return, we're right back to the beginning of the episode with the same shot and sound of an alarm clock going off and a gloved hand reaching out to shut it off. But while before the time was 7:30, now the time is almost 11. Shortly after Mabel turns the alarm off, the telephone rings. The camera pans over to show Mabel in the same outfit we saw at the beginning of the episode. And she, for a moment, goes back in time, too, calling out,
"Henry!"
Before remembering and realizing she'll have to answer the phone herself, which is easy enough for her to do because it's right there on the bedside table.
Hello?
Mabel, this is Mr. Abernathy. Where's Henry?
Henry? Oh, he's not here.
Well, he's not in his office, and he should be. It's 11 o'clock. Now, where is he?
We get a shot of Mr. Abernathy in his office, and he is played by Vinton Hayworth in his third of four appearances after Mink and Malice Domestic. His next and last is Night of the Execution, episode 13 of season 3.
Well, he's gone. He's left me.
What are you talking about?
It's true, Mr. Abernathy. Henry's left me for another woman. He's run off with her. And after all I've done for him.
This is an amusing line, because clearly Mabel has done nothing for Henry except kill him. But she is in Martha Mason mode again, perhaps becoming, as the title of the film suggested, the forgotten woman.
All right, Mabel, all right. Now calm down. Now, you and Henry had a fight. That happens in every family, but that doesn't mean he's walked out on you.
But he has. He's gone. He left a note. He said he was never coming back.
No, what's he say? Have you got it there?
Yes, it's right here.
Well, read it to me.
We get a close-up of the sheet of paper that Mabel has picked up, and it, of course, is blank.
He said he was running away with her.
Mabel, you told me that. Read me what he says. Never mind, never mind. Just sit tight. I'll be right out.
Our shots of Mr. Abernathy are reminiscent of our shots of Henry. Looks of annoyance and frustration on his face. Mabel is clearly a known character. Mabel hangs up with a look of satisfaction on her face, but then looks at the blank piece of paper and realizes she has to get busy. So we dissolve down to her at the typewriter, hunting and pecking out Henry's note, even as Mr. Abernathy's car arrives. She finishes the note just in time, and even as Mr. Abernathy is ringing the doorbell, she pulls out a canceled check with Henry's signature on it, Henry G. McKay, and forges his first name onto her note. Before she lets Mr. Abernathy in, she gets into character, pulls out a handkerchief, and pretends to have been crying. He comes in and asks for the note. It turns out to be so cartoonish that it's an obvious forgery, and Mr. Abernathy clearly has his doubts as he reads it.
Dear Mabel, I have never been worthy of you, and I know it. So I am taking the coward's way out of everything. I am running away with another woman. Another woman who I am not worthy of. She is not as beautiful or as charming, and she doesn't look like a movie star. Movie star? What the devil's he talking about?
He means he always said that I resemble Martha Mason, the movie star.
Since I am unworthy of you, I want to let you be free to lead your own life. I shall always love you. Henry. Oh, rubbish. That isn't Henry.
Mr. Abernathy hits the nail on the head right there, but then he swings and misses.
But he signed it. That's his signature.
Well, I know that, but that isn't the real Henry. Well, there's no one in town as steady and as responsible as Henry.
A responsible man doesn't desert his wife.
Well, but Henry's just at that dangerous age. What is he, 47?
Mm-hmm.
He's having a fling. Well, you know what I mean, Mabel. He's going through that restless period. Now, in a week or so, he'll come sneaking back home, mighty ashamed of himself.
Oh, I don't think he'll ever come back.
And Mabel knows whereof she speaks.
Oh, of course he will. But the best thing to do is...
And now, all unknowing, Mr. Abernathy aids and abets.
Is not talk about it. Now, if anybody asks, just tell them that, that I sent Henry to Chicago on a business trip. Oh, Mabel, you've got to act like nothing's happened. Keep your spirits up. Go shopping. Nothing like a new hat to cheer a woman up, they tell me. You take my word for it. In a week or two, Henry will be puttering in that garden as his big as life. You just watch and see.
I suppose you could say that Henry is puttering in that garden now, just not big as life. Mr. Abernathy can't wait to get out of there, and as soon as he closes the front door, Mabel drops her act. After we fade out and fade back in, it appears that Mabel has taken Mr. Abernathy's advice. She is wearing a new hat, and she has a couple of packages in her arms. But she also seems to sense that something is wrong or different, because instead of going inside, she walks around to the backyard to find Mr. Abernathy there, looking down at Henry's garden.
I've just been admiring Henry's garden, these lilies.
And there are about a dozen lilies that have sprouted and are growing there.
The fertilizer he put on must have been good stuff.
That line goes by so fast that we almost don't realize how unknowingly grotesque it is.
Well, he tried everything.
Finally found something that worked.
The same with that line.
Yeah, that proves he'll be back. Man doesn't work this hard and then just walk out and leave it.
Mr. Abernathy joins her inside to tell her that in spite of his story about Henry going to Chicago, word has gotten around that Henry has run off with another woman. It's never stated one or the other, but Mabel has probably spread that story herself.
Well, everybody knows what he's done. There just isn't any use in lying to people.
Well, it makes it all the harder for Henry when he comes back. Now, we've got to do something about it.
I am doing something. I'm carrying on the best I can. It hasn't been easy, I can tell you.
Well, I appreciate that, Mabel, but we've got to think of Henry.
Well, Henry didn't think of me. He's made his bed, now he... Well, I mean, he can get out of it the best he can. Well, I mean, why should it fall on my shoulders?
Two more ironic lines there. Henry has not made his own bed, and he is not getting out of it. But it is at this moment that Mr. Abernathy makes a big mistake, along the lines of Henry's mistake of telling Mabel she doesn't look like Martha Mason.
Well, no, Mabel, there are two sides to everything, you know. A husband doesn't run away from a happy home. Now, maybe you haven't been the wife you should be, huh?
Why, that's a terrible thing to say. Why, you don't know what I've had to put up with. You're on his side because he's a large brother, but I'm his wife, and he ran off and deserted me. Why, I could bring charges against
him. Now, simmer down, Mabel.
For desertion and non-support. Well, I could have him arrested. All I have to do is to pick up that telephone.
Well, you do that, and you'll never see him again.
Well, that's just fine with me. I wouldn't have him back on a bed.
Mabel, put down that phone. Mabel, I'm warning you, if you go through with this, I'll wash my hands of the entire affair.
Oh, you don't care about me anyway. It's that precious lodge that you're worried about.
Not true, Mabel.
Hello, this is Mrs. Henry McKay.
Mabel.
My husband ran off and left me, and
Mabel,
I want him arrested.
I'm warning you, Mabel.
Yes. Oh, well, then, could you send an officer over to my house? I'm just not well enough to go out.
That sound was the door as Mr. Abernathy leaves, and true to his word, we don't see him again. But it's also worth noting that when Mabel calls Mr. Abernathy a lodge brother, he doesn't say something along the lines of, Henry doesn't go to the lodge, which seems to be a bit of a lapse, considering what we learn at the end of the episode. Mabel's phone call does the trick, and there is soon a detective at her home, which we are told is...
840 Lanning Street.
A detail that I love because it's so unnecessary. He stands above her as she sits on the couch telling her story.
I had no warning at all. I just woke up one morning and found this note.
Thank you. When was this?
About 10 days ago.
Well, if you'd reported it at the time, Ms. McKay, he's probably out of the state by now.
Well, I had to be sure that it wasn't just a fling, you know. See, he's a great deal older than I am. The restless age, and well, I thought if it was just something he had to get out of his system.
Yes, ma'am, I understand. Not many wives would look at it that way. It's a lot more than he deserves.
The detective is played by Rusty Lane in his third of 7 Alfred Hitchcock Presents and 2 Alfred Hitchcock Hour appearances, after None Are So Blind and The Manacled. His next is The Young One, episode 9 of season 3. The detective asks for an example of Henry's signature to be sure that the signature on the note is legit, and Mabel goes and gets the check that she used to forge a signature, which seems to satisfy the detective.
That's his signature, all right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll sure do everything we can. And don't you worry, Mrs. McKay. I've heard talk in town, and everybody's on your side.
Well, everyone has been so kind. I try not to let it get me down.
Not many women could do it.
Thank you, officer. Officer, do you ever see Martha Mason, the movie star?
Sure, my wife drags me to all her pictures. Why do you ask?
Well, no reason, I just wondered.
We fade out and in again as Mabel enters the police station. There are two other officers there, extras, and the detective, who gives Mabel some paperwork. She takes it over to a table. She looks to her right. There's a tramp sleeping on a bench. She looks to her left. There's a woman lighting a cigarette, her hand shaking just a bit. Both of these people seem to annoy her, but she sets to work until she is quickly called by the detective over to his desk. Now, there is another woman at the detective's desk who leaves before he calls Mabel over, and the Alfred Hitchcock Presents companion lists a character named Bernice, played by Claire Carlton. We've seen Claire before in And So Died Rhea Bushinska, and while there's a resemblance here, I don't think that this woman is Claire. So I'm not going to count it as one of Claire's appearances, but I will say that Claire next appears in The Jokester, Episode 3 of Season 4. All right, the big finish.
We think we've found your husband.
Oh, well, it couldn't be Henry. I mean, he's run off with some girl off the street.
No, ma'am. Henry didn't run anywhere.
How can you say that? Well, you haven't even looked for him. Well, who says he didn't run away?
I told them he didn't.
The woman who was lighting the cigarette.
What do you know about it?
I know Henry didn't run off with another woman because I'm the other woman.
Making her, perhaps, the forgotten woman of the movie title.
When we found out about her, we figured maybe Henry was still at home. So some of the boys went out to your place, and as soon as you left the house, they started to look around.
You're not going to listen to this woman, are you? Why, she doesn't even know my husband.
Oh, yes, I do. Every Thursday night when he was supposed to be at his lodge, Henry was visiting me. And he wouldn't go off anywhere without taking me along.
Why, she's lying!
No, ma'am. The boys saw how well those lilies were doing, so they dug them up to see why. And there was Henry. Hold her for murder.
One of the officers comes over and taps Mabel on the shoulder. And she goes into the Martha Mason faint, ending up in the arms of the police officer, just like Martha Mason in the movie poster. The other woman was played by Karen Norris, who was born Verna Karen Peterson in Fresno, California. Her mother was 40 years old and her father 49 years old when she was born. She started as a chorus girl in the Earl Carroll Review, then began appearing on stage in 1946, often at the Pasadena Playhouse, later becoming an instructor at the Pasadena City College. Now, she often played salesgirls and secretaries, such as her role in the Invaders episode Wall of Crystal.
And so, until tomorrow, this is Theodore Booth saying good night.
Nice show, Mr. B.
Thank you, Ann. Will you tell Phil? Never mind. Phil, thank you one and all. And never mind playing back the tape. I'll catch it on the air tonight, maybe. Will you call the press club and confirm that luncheon tomorrow with the undersecretary?
Yes, sir.
But she also got to be the giant mother in the Twilight Zone episode, Stopover in a Quiet Town.
Be careful with your pets, dear. Daddy brought them all away from Earth.
Oh, can I play with them, Mommy?
After lunch, dear. Right now, put them back. Go on.
And she graduated to being a judge in the Ironside episode, Achilles' Heel, her last role.
Let the record show at this preliminary hearing The defendant, Otis Williams, will be represented by a public defender, Mr. Austin Quill. Are the people ready, Mr. Arnstein?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
But you can also find her in Pillow Talk and The Manchurian Candidate, and in episodes of Perry Mason, Death Valley Days, Get Smart, Bewitched, and Lassie. Karen Norris died in 1996 at the age of 69. This is her only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance. We also have yet another new director of photography. He is Ellis J. Bud Thackeray. He spent most of his pre-television career at Republic Pictures, beginning in 1934 doing special photographic effects for Are We Civilized? He was nominated for an Oscar in 1940 for special effects in the film Women in War. And his first job as cinematographer was in 1941's The Gay Vagabond. He mainly moved over to television in the early 50s and worked until 1977 in a number of series, such as 12 episodes of McHale's Navy, 15 episodes of State Trooper, 23 episodes of Frontier Doctor, 50 episodes of The Restless Gun, 52 episodes of Wagon Train, 108 episodes of Tales of Wells Fargo, and 166 episodes of Ironside. Bud Thackeray died in 1990 at the age of 87, and this is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode, although he does have three Alfred Hitchcock Hours to his credit, his next being 10 Minutes From Now, episode 26 of season 2. Our author, Raymond Mason, was born in Plattsmouth, Nebraska, in 1926. NebraskaAuthors.org says that he attended Kansas City Junior College in 1943 and again in 1948 to 49. That gap probably signifies his time serving in World War II. He gained a Bachelor of Arts from San Francisco State College in 1952 and a Master of Arts from the same college in 1970. He was a writer and editor for newspapers, a feature writer and advertising copywriter, an advertising manager, and he worked at the United States Merchant Marine, Florence Wine Company in San Francisco, Montclarian Publications in Oakland, the Daily Argus in Fremont, California, and Lesher Publications in Walnut Creek, California. Jack Seabrook, in his blog, says that the Fiction Mags Index lists three short stories by Raymond Mason, all appearing in Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine in 1957 or 1958. Jack adds, I also located five paperback originals by this author in the same time period, and Two Shall Meet, 1954, Forever Is Today, 1955, Love After Five, 1956, Bedeviled, 1960, and Someone and Felicia Warwick, 1962. NebraskaAuthors.org also adds that he was a contributor to John Trinian's The Big Grab in 1960. Jack also says the back cover copy for Forever Is Today states that Mason was this generation's spokesman for the young and the damned, but what that means is anyone's guess. All of the novels but Bedeviled were in the Gold Medal series, which was an imprint belonging to Fawcett Publications, in which they published paperback originals, an unusual concept at the time. Now, I don't have a date of death for Raymond, but I do know that this is not only his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents contribution, but his only contribution to any television or film. This is his only credit listed on IMDb. Now, if you're wondering why Raymond Mason gave the movie star in his story his last name, the answer is that he didn't. Robert C. Dennis did that with his teleplay, because the title of Raymond Mason's story is Martha Myers, Movie Star. It appears in Volume 2, Number 1 of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, dated January 1957, which is actually the second issue altogether. The story's appearance is used by the episode to publicize the magazine. As the closing credits read, teleplay by Robert C. Dennis, based on a story by Raymond Mason, as published in the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine. Now, while the story is written in the third person, the narrator is clearly tuned in to Mabel's point of view. The story is much the same as the episode, although Henry's garden is, strangely enough, in his basement. But what makes the story work, and what the episode lacks, is that connection to Mabel in the narration. It begins, Mabel was very unhappy about her life. She was also unhappy with Henry. She was in her middle 30s, had mousy brown hair, most of her own teeth, and considered herself in appearance not unlike Martha Myers, the movie star, although she didn't really resemble anybody who was in the movies. Henry, on the other hand, was short, middle-aged, bald-headed, and had a little mustache. He was very attached to his home and to his wife and to his garden in the basement. He only deserted them on Thursday night when his lodge held its weekly meeting. Mabel didn't like Henry. She knew it wasn't the right thing to do when she had married him 3 years before, but she had been so short of choices at that time. She had come to the small town they lived in only a short time before that, and she hadn't had any money, and the only place she had been able to find work was in a boarding house where she had to wait tables and do domestic work. When Henry proposed, it had been an out. She left the boarding house. Everything about Henry griped Mabel, even down to the little bow tie he snapped on every morning. But his damned garden in the basement probably bothered her the most. This was complete foolishness and a waste of time. The only good part of it was that she didn't have to look at him in the house while he worked on it, but he was always calling for her to come down and see what he was doing. This griped Mabel, too. So Mabel kills Henry, dumps him in the hole he has dug in the basement, and starts to fill it in. It was a hell of a job, and the dirt wouldn't fit back into the hole from where it came. This made her angry, and she was certain that Henry was probably taking up too much room in the hole. That was what made the dirt come out long. He was still being a jerk. She threw the extra dirt around on the rest of the garden, not covering anything up, because nothing was growing anyway. But looking at it bothered her. It seemed like somebody could be buried here. If the police or anyone came here, they would probably think somebody was buried in the garden. It was all bare, and it was covered with loose dirt. It didn't really look like a garden. She ran upstairs and brought back two potted philodendrons. She dug a hole in the loose dirt and planted the flowers, pots and all. Then she covered them well so that nothing showed except the plants. Mabel made several trips upstairs until she had found every potted plant, and there were quite a few since Henry liked them, and returned to the basement and set them up as though they were growing there. After 2 hours of this, she looked at the indoor garden and laughed. Nothing had ever grown this well before. In fact, nothing had ever grown before, and now there were 10 or 11 full-grown plants coming out of the ground. They were strung out all over so as to cover the space. Mabel went upstairs and took a long hot shower. Soon after, Mabel writes Henry's letter, which is very much like the letter in the episode. Then, all prepared, she is the one who calls Mr. Abernathy and reads it to him. She was happy the old geezer had swallowed the idea of Henry running away with somebody. She laughed out loud. Honest, they had to be pretty dumb to believe that story. Dumb-looking little jerk Henry finding anybody who would want to run off with him. Well, it was a big world. For the next week, after word gets around, Mabel becomes very popular. There was a time or two when she thought about Henry, planted down in the garden, but she tried not to let this worry her. He was happy down there. He had always loved the garden and to putter in the dirt. Now he was part of the earth itself. Besides, he didn't have any fun living anyway. He probably didn't even have much fun at the lodge, Mabel thought. If he had, then why hadn't he joined another one? Heaven knows she asked him enough times. On the 10th day after the murder, Mabel gets a visit from Officer Merkin, who tells her, "You see, we have a missing persons section here at the police department. It's not a very important section because practically nobody ever comes up missing in a little town like this. But I'm in charge of this department, and somebody is missing now. Henry's missing." So she goes to the station with Officer Merkin, and the story ends like this. All the policemen there were very nice, but there was one old drunk they had arrested who wasn't nice at all. He kept screaming that he had been buried alive or something, and she thought this was a perfectly horrible thing to even be discussing, let alone yelling it at the top of his lungs. Nobody was ever buried alive anyway. They were always hit in the head with something first. The other person she didn't like was a cheap-looking blonde who sat on a bench with her legs crossed. She looked like a woman of the street. Somebody who had probably run off with a happily married man. Her type was always in the movies, but no movie star like Martha Myers, the movie star, ever played a part like that. Somebody who was not a star always played those parts. She brought the form over to Officer Merkin's desk. Most of the blanks were filled out. He motioned for her to sit down, and she did. The telephone rang, and he picked it up. "Yeah?" he said. "Really?" There was the sound of someone speaking in the earpiece, but Mabel couldn't hear what was being said. "I declare, I wouldn't believe it. Noises. Well, you never know." Then he hung up the telephone, and he was looking at Mabel. His face was very serious now, and he seemed to be touching his holster with one hand, as though he were about to arrest a dangerous criminal. "They found Henry, ma'am." "What?" "Yes, ma'am. Some of the boys went out to your place while we were here. They found him under the philodendrons. No, that's impossible. They couldn't have found anybody. Henry ran off with some girl of the streets. The little jerk ran away from his wife and his responsibilities. He didn't run anywhere, ma'am. He was planted in the garden. Mabel jumped up, carried away by the moment. What would Martha Myers, the movie star, do in a situation like this? Why did you even look for Henry in the garden? Why would you think anything could happen to Henry in his own house? The house with a wife that loved him. Mabel was so carried away, she was almost ready to faint. Why couldn't he have run away with some other woman? She shrieked. The blonde had come across the room to get a closer view of the performance and was standing next to her as she gestured. She poked Mabel in the ribs. I told them he didn't run away with anybody. He couldn't have run away with anybody, 'cause I'm the other woman, hon. And she motioned toward herself. Every Thursday night, just me and old good time Henry, and he wouldn't have run off anywhere without taking little me along. Mabel passed out, falling flat on her face. Martha Myers, the movie star, might have fainted that way, but probably not.
Of course, my experiments with the blackmail picture, it was started as a silent picture.
C'est ça. Oui. Et certaines scènes ont été retournées après
pour le son. And certain scenes were then shut over again for sound.
Well, the interesting, slightly romantic side of that is that I was asked to prepare the last scene only, last reel in sound.
La dernière bobine en son.
Because in those days when talk first came in, they used to advertise it as parts sound,
partiellement en son.
And they made a novelty of the sound starting in the middle of the picture.
Ah, oui, oui.
You see, when I knew that they were going to make the thing into sound, I was shooting in silence. I prepared in my own mind
j'ai préparé
to make
dans ma
the whole
tête
film,
de faire tout le film
sound.
En sonore.
And I knew where certain talking scenes
et
went
je savais
in.
Où certaines scènes parlantes allaient entrer. Mm-hmm.
That was Hitch talking to François Truffaut about the conversion of his film Blackmail from silent to sound. I discussed the silent version of Blackmail back in the podcast for episode 66, I Killed the Count, Part 3, and I'm finally getting to the sound version, as promised. As Hitch says there, he was asked only to do the last reel in sound. In his book, Hitch, The Life and Times of Alfred Hitchcock, John Russell Taylor writes that the conversion to sound was an investment that John Maxwell, the head of British International Pictures, was reluctant to make, despite Hitch's urging. Hitch was longing to get into the new medium and let his mind play freely around the question of how he would make Blackmail if it were a talkie, but there seemed no way that it could be, and he started shooting it as a silent film. History was catching up with the British film, however, and while Blackmail was in production, Maxwell made the decision to jump on the sound bandwagon by putting some dialogue in the last reel so that the film could be advertised as part talking. As far as they knew in the front office, this was all Hitch was doing. But Hitch had more confidence and more guile than that. Hitch felt that there was more than enough very visual material in the film for him to experiment with sound effects and snatches of dialogue elsewhere than in the last reel. So that is what he did. To such effect that when he presented his producers with the part-talkie version, he was able to impress them with the sensational possibilities of the new medium in his hands. From there, it was a short step to getting them to allow him to reshoot certain key scenes as a fully-fledged talking picture. However, in the conversion of the film from silent to sound, as Patrick McGilligan puts it in his book, Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light, Annie Andra was the most delicate issue. Hitch was not going to replace Annie, but she had a pronounced Czech accent, and you may recall her screen test, which I played in the podcast for One More Mile to Go.
Now, Miss Andra, you asked me to let you hear your voice on the talking picture.
But Hitch, you mustn't do that.
Why not?
Well, because I can speak well.
And yet, when the dinner date scene between Alice and Frank is converted to sound, the voices sound like this.
Do you expect the entire machinery of Scotland Yard to be held up to please you?
You and your Scotland Yard. It went for Edgar Wallace. Nobody's ever heard of it.
Funny, aren't you? Anyway, what's the hurry? We're only going to the pictures. We've got all evening.
Well, I don't think I want to go to the pictures.
Oh, and why not?
I've seen everything worth seeing.
You haven't seen Fingerprints. I'd like you to see that. Still, it's about Scotland Yard. It might be amusing. They're bound to get all the details wrong.
In Alfred Hitchcock, A Portrait in Darkness and Light, Patrick McGilligan points out that Edgar Wallace was known as the King of the Thriller for his suspenseful books and plays often involving Scotland Yard. And he says that when Frank insists that the picture should be amusing, but they're bound to get all the details wrong, it is a jibe at Hitchcock's own craft. McGilligan says while others were deep-thinking sound, Hitchcock was having fun. But that's rather beside the point. In these early days of sound, there was no means to dub anyone's voices. So how did Annie Andra lose her Czech accent? Well, in The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock, Donald Spoto writes, Hitchcock asked BIP to engage the aspiring young actress Joan Barry to stand just off camera, speaking Andra's lines of dialogue into a microphone as the actress mouthed them. So, dubbing on the fly, as it were. This was as good a resolution as could be found, but it had two drawbacks. For one thing, Joan Barry's diction was just what a Cockney girl's would not be, refined, studied, slow, and somewhat self-consciously arty. And the other problem was the inevitable series of awkward pauses in the scenes they reshot with the two women. Viewers can sense the actors obeying off-camera cues, or at least something everyone notices is not quite right in the timing. Now, in their talk, Truffaut mentions...
There was surtout une scène au piano qui a été refaite avec le son,
piano scene, I think, that was remade with sound.
Hitch is not much interested in this.
Well, the whole thing was sound at the end.
But Truffaut is right. John Russell Taylor writes, the villain is played by Cyril Richard, later famous in America as the king of light comedy and musicals. His talents in the musical direction are even employed in Blackmail by having him do a musical number at the piano before he is knifed.
They say you're wild and naughty child, Miss Up Today. And loom if you predict for you an awful fate. Critics of today won't pardon you. It's such a shame the way they're hard on you. Although you're no saint, stop a plate, smoke and paint, drink a cocktail or two. Why this alarm? For there's really no harm in the cute little things that you do. You've a heart of gold, so let them nag and scold. You're absolutely great, Miss Up Today.
And that's a song about you, my dear.
There are some other nice audio touches. In Hitchcock, the first 44 films, Eric Rohmer and Claude Chabrol write, how can we help but admire the continuity a shriek achieves between the shot in which Alice suddenly finds herself face to face with the tramp lying in the position of the dead painter and the following shot of the charwoman discovering the body.
Who did you say it was?
Mr. Crewe.
Mr. who?
No, Crewe, I tell you. It's horrible.
And they also note the moment in which the shop bell over the door resounds in Alice's head like a knell.
What's the matter, Alice? Had another hour with Frank?
In The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock, Donald Spoto references John Longdon, who played Frank, as saying that the sound apparatus itself was rather primitive, and that he remembered the large box about 2 feet square hanging over his head, and Hitchcock calling instructions to talk up into a microphone dangling from it. And Spoto quotes Longdon directly as saying, this, besides tending to a crick in the neck, hardly contributed to a smooth portrayal of my part. The other memory is of a scene in which I, as a detective, had to walk nonchalantly round a room searching for evidence. As the sequence had to be tense, Hitch did not want to add music, so he suggested that I should whistle some tune. At this time, the singing fool, The first big American talkie success in England was all the rage, so Hitch told me to whistle Sonny Boy from that picture. This cheeky gesture seems to me the most typical Hitchcock touch of them all.
All right, Doctor. What do you mean? Yeah. Don't go and do any more?
No. Hmm? Nothing here, anything to do, sir.
Well, there are great times. I don't mind the great times. You make them blue, tell you, boy.
But the best of these audio touches is so memorable that Hitchcock describes it to Truffaut at length.
Because I had that famous use of sound when the girl has committed the murder.
Quand la fille a commis le meurtre.
And she goes home and there's a scene at the breakfast table of her family. And there's a talkative neighbor from next door.
Et une voisine très bavarde d'à côté.
And the neighbor is talking about the murder
around
the corner. And what a terrible thing to kill a man in the back with a knife.
Et quelle terrible chose c'est que de tuer un homme dans le dos avec un couteau.
The woman said if I were committing a murder,
si c'était moi qui
I'd hit prendre. Him over the head with a brick, but I wouldn't use a knife.
Mais je me servirais pas d'un couteau.
And as her dialogue went on, it became a sound of talk, and the talk became less clear, except one word, knife.
Excepté pour une parole qui était couteau.
Knife. And I played it on the girl's face, and it dies away. It goes a long way away, but all you can hear is knife, knife.
On n'entend que des sons vagues et couteau, couteau, couteau,
couteau. Suddenly, the voice of the father. Pass the bread knife, would you please, Alice?
Passe-moi le couteau à pain, tu veux, Alice?
And she has to pick up the same knife she's just committed the murder.
Et elle doit ramasser le même couteau avec lequel elle vient de commettre le meurtre.
But it was the contrast of the to the normal voice coming back. That was the first experiment with sound.
What's wrong, Alice? You don't look very chirpy this morning.
You do look a bit peaky, I must say.
Dad, Alice, breakfast.
Good morning, Mr. White.
Good morning, sir. Good morning. Breakfast? I couldn't look Bacon in the face after what happened last night. And under our very noses.
Mind you, I don't think myself it's altogether the police's fault. What I mean is they had to wink at some things. I mean, it's one thing to buy chocolates out of ours, but it's quite another to stick a knife into a gentleman. I must say I feel the same way about that, too. A good, clean, honest whack over the head with a brick is one thing. There's something British about that. But knives. No, knives is not right. I must say that's what I think and that's what I feel. Whatever the provocation, I could never use a knife. Now, mind you, a knife is a difficult thing to handle. I mean, any knife. I mean, if you use a pen knife, or a pocket knife, they wouldn't belong to you. Knife.
Alice, cut us a bit of bread, will you?
Knife. What's that other knife? Knife. A knife is a dangerous thing. You be careful of a knife. You come up against a knife. Oh, no. I mean, in Chelsea, you mustn't use a knife.
Yeah, you ought to have been more careful. Might have cut somebody with that.
Now, Hitch is wrong about it being the same knife with which she killed the man. But speaking about it 30 years later, he remembered it pretty well. Interestingly, as Patrick McGilligan puts it, the biggest sacrifice to the extended shooting schedule was Phyllis Constom, who was playing the gossiping neighbor. Constom had to fulfill a previous stage engagement, and Phyllis Monkman stepped into her part, refilming the scenes with sound. To simplify the billing, neither actress was credited. Phyllis Constom is not the only victim to the transition. Thomas Leitch's The Encyclopedia of Alfred Hitchcock notes that Sam Livesey was replaced by Harvey Brabban as the chief inspector, and it states that this led to considerable textual complications in the two release versions of the film, because not only does the sync sound version retain a good deal of the silent version's footage, but also the silent version incorporates some of the footage shot for sound. Both versions are available on the Blackmail DVD, so you can compare and contrast with those scenes if you'd like. Now, that scene was a sensation in its time. And in The Dark Side of Genius, Donald Spoto writes, "This is one of the most discussed scenes in the history of the early sound film, and rightly so." So Blackmail was a hit. In Alfred Hitchcock, A Brief Life, Peter Aykroyd quotes the Daily Chronicle, who celebrated the fact that after the nasal sound of American accents, the English voices in Blackmail are like music, and notes that at the public screening in the Regal Cinema in the summer of 1929, the film was punctuated at times with almost continual bursts of applause, one of which lasted for 7 minutes. Unfortunately, the film was rejected outright for distribution in the United States. In counterpoint to the Daily Chronicle quote, Patrick McGilligan notes that the reasons given were many and irritating, but the upshot was simple. Americans couldn't decipher the English accents. And while John Russell Taylor says that though Hitch was to have his reverses and thin periods during the next few years, there was never again after Blackmail any danger of his being ignored or discounted, Patrick McGilligan writes, "Regardless of whether Blackmail was the first British talkie, the verdict was that he had taken too long and spent too much money to produce the film. America was underwhelmed by his achievement, and censorship hurt prospects in the English territories. There are no reliable box office figures from that era, but any profits from the film were modest. It couldn't have helped his standing at BIP that his budding mystique was creating something of a backlash. Already his detractors had formed an anti-Hitchcock club. Although Hitchcock survived the August massacre, John Maxwell put him on notice. He needed to accelerate his productivity, diversify his subject matter, and direct commercially attractive films." In the end, years later, speaking to Truffaut, Hitch has some qualms about the sound version.
"But of course, it, to me, it, that shows today, if you looked at the film today, it's still a silent film.
C'est encore un film muet.
And practically with the people speaking titles."
In Hitchcock, the first 44 films, Eric Rohmer and Claude Chabrol agree with Hitchcock, but they say the acting was by and large better than in the previous silence, and that the performance as conceived by Hitchcock required sound. In this respect, the difference between the two versions is striking. Despite the mediocrity of the delivery, the sound version is better acted than the silent version. The stylization, more or less consciously imposed on the actors by Hitchcock, found its raison d'etre with sound. In the book Hitchcock Truffaut, Hitch talks about his farewell to silent films, speaking of the scene in which Alice is nearly raped by the Cyril Richard character. He tells Truffaut, "I did a funny thing in that scene, a sort of farewell to silent pictures. On the silent screen, the villain was generally a man with a mustache. Well, my villain was clean-shaven, but an ironwork chandelier in his studio cast a shadow on his upper lip that suggested an absolutely fierce-looking mustache." Unfortunately, the farewell to silent pictures also, needless to say, spelled the end of Annie Andra's career in British cinema. In The Dark Side of Genius, Donald Spoto writes, "She returned to Germany, where she divorced filmmaker Carol Lamach, married the prizefighter Max Schmeling, and retired to a small town near Hamburg. At Christmas in 1930, she sent Hitchcock and Alma a card and wrote on it of her new happiness. Hitchcock sent back his seasonal greeting that year. 'Alfred, Alma, and Pat Hitchcock wish you a happy Christmas,' read the printed green sentiment inside, and to it Hitchcock added simply, 'A boxer!' 'Hitchy,' she wrote back at once, 'I'm so happy here.'" He also quotes Hugh Castle, a critic of the time, who said, "It must be said that, considering that he was toying with a medium about which he knew nothing, he has made a good job of it. Blackmail is perhaps the most intelligent mixture of sound and silence we have yet seen. It is Hitchcock's comeback. While seeing it, you can hardly believe that it was made by the man who gave us Champagne or The Manx Man. Hitchcock succeeds in wedding sound with silence." In his review of the episode, Jack Seabrook says, "Martha Mason, movie star, is dragged down by an average script and unimaginative direction. Judith Evelyn is not likable as Mabel, and Robert Emhart is not on screen long enough as Henry. The story by Raymond Mason is entertaining, but the TV adaptation is much less so." And yes, I agree with all of that, but even in the midst of its spoiled humor and undone suspense, there is a feeling of the grotesque, not just in the ironic comments made about Henry.
"In a week or two, Henry will be puttering in that garden as his biggest life. You just watch and see. I've just been admiring Henry's garden. These lilies, the fertilizer he put on must have been good stuff.
Well, he tried everything.
Finally found something that worked.
He's made his bed, now he... Well, I mean, he can get out of it the best he can.
But in Henry's own deception, in which he cheats on Mabel, but not extensively because joining two lodges would be selfishness.
Well, belonging to a lodge is every man's civic duty. But joining two would be selfishness. I'm not the type of man who'd neglect his wife and his home.
Perhaps if Mabel knew about this, she wouldn't think Henry was so very dull.
Henry, I suppose it just never occurs to you that being married to you is pretty dull.
Not to mention having actual grounds for divorce. The greatest grotesquery, of course, is Mabel's fixation on celebrity, in which she tries to participate by thinking that she looks like Martha Mason, even going so far as to act out in various roles.
He drove me to it. I begged him to release me, to give me my freedom. He refused.
And killing Henry is initially such a role that when she wakes up the next morning, she forgets that she did it.
Henry!
Before she can settle into the role of the abandoned wife.
It's true, Mr. Abernathy. Henry's left me for another woman.
So from swooning, to crying, to performing her dumb show before striking the killing blow, Mabel is on stage all the time in her regular life. Now, in this age of reality shows and social media, it sometimes feels like the sole goal of people's lives is to become famous in any way that they can. So Mabel would fit right in today, and she might even be happy in her new role. She may not look like Martha Mason, but she first gets to star as the jilted wife.
I've heard talk in town, and everybody's on your side.
And her false feint at the end seems to imply that she'll play to the hilt the role of the murderer of a husband. The real irony here, though, is that the best actor, the one who consistently and successfully plays his role during his home life, turns out to be dull old Henry. Now here's Hitch, still in his space helmet, to wrap things up.
Poor Mabel. I'm afraid she just didn't have a green thumb.
I shall return after this word from the people who make this program possible. That is, when they are not making things impossible. Alfred Hitchcock Presents Season 2, The Goodbye Girl, Saturday Night Live, The Complete First Season, 1975 to 1976, The Outer Limits, Season 2, The Twilight Zone, The Complete Fifth Season, and Blackmail, which includes the Hitchcock-Truffaut interview, are all available at the Ann Arbor District Library. The film I've Always Loved You, the Anison commercial, Al Jolson singing Sunny Boy, and the Ironside episode Achilles' Heel are all available online. If you would like to contact me about this podcast, please email me at sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. That's sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. And please put Hitchcock somewhere in the subject line. Next time, Episode 74, The West Warlock Time Capsule, starring Henry Jones and Mildred Dunnock.
Next time, we shall be back with another story. Meanwhile, I'm off to another planet. I've always been curious about Venus.
He walks back to his spaceship's ladder and begins to climb it.
Good night.